This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
It's my great pleasure to be here today in conversation with Janet Holmes of Court, and to have all of you people sitting there in the dark, because we're going to try and have a conversation and ignore you. But it's probably, we sort of do know you're there, so we won't go into any really rude stories. And we'll just, fairly free flow conversation style interaction today. And obviously we'll have an opportunity to, at some point in the end, for you to also participate if you have a few things to comment on or questions even. It'd be really good. So there is a role for you other than me pretending you're not there. So Janet, of course, was born in Perth around about the same time as me, actually. She's an Australian businesswoman. She's the owner of one of Australia's largest private companies. I know many of you will know all this, but so we're on the same page for one part at least. Heightsbury, and she turned around the fortunes of the struggling group that she began to manage after the death of her husband, Robert Holmes, at court. She attended the University of Western Australia, majoring in organic chemistry.
Something completely different.
Yeah, came into all phases of your life, from muesli making to the only woman in. You're the only woman in the course, so that's the first of many firsts, I suspect. After graduation, she worked for a time as a science teacher before marrying Robert Holmes of Court in 1966, and she had four children. So you can do it all. As her children matured and gradually left home, she developed interests in a whole range of things on a whole lot of boards, including medical research, the arts, and a number of other charitable organisations, which she has done with great energy and alacrity since. After her husband died, of course, she had probably one of the most enormous challenges of her life, taking over such an proactive company after Robert Holmes of Court, who was, of course, a different individual with a different style of doing business. And Janet obviously had a very large decision to make and made the decision to make it work and to keep it alive and make it work, and put her own particular skills and personality in that and change the direction of the company, which then survived on a very different course. And is, as we all know, a very active in a whole range of areas, which I'm sure will come out during the course of the conversation. So we are very grateful that Janet... Emily's very grateful that Janet's so active in a whole range of areas, and so are we. I clearly don't know half of those other areas, but the parts that interact with me that I hear about, I'm extremely impressed. She is also, as you know, been an active participant, or you may not know, in various social issues as an advocate of the Australian Republican movement at the 1998 Constitutional Convention, and the chairperson of the Australian Children's Television Foundation, which I know she is very passionate about. Because I had the good fortune of being one of the participants on the 2020 summit, along with a couple of other mates. And I know she was really concerned enough to ring and ask if there was an appropriate opportunity to, bring this up as a really important and valuable thing that was happening, that children's television actually gets the support it needs, which was a very pragmatic suggestion on how to do so. And fortunately, we did have an opportunity to say that. Where it goes, who knows? She's also chairperson of the West Australian Symphony Orchestra. She's still chairperson there. Mm-hmm. And also served on the board of the Reserve Bank of Australia. So you can see it's pretty widespread. And at the end of the day, if you're just being who you are and believing what you believe in, then it's in some ways irrelevant what the actual content of the board is. It's bringing new visions and integrity and skills to it. She told me not to read too much of this, but anyway, I never listen to anyone. So, she, you know, and appropriately so, she's had a few gongs on the way. The Order of Australia 1995 and promoted the Companion of the Order 07. So she's also an honorary fellow of the Australian Institute of Building, a professional institute that's incorporated into the Royal Charter. And she, I know she has a lot of I couldn't begin to tell you about her interest in that sort of the building construction side of things, but you too can go to Wikipedia. But one of the interesting things is that amongst these business interests, of course, is Heightsbury beef. Is that you still got that? I mean, things change, you know, overnight, so you have to check. Large cattle breeding and export company, and Vass Felix. I know about that because you were in Japan with the Cards, which are a major winery in Western Australia's Margaret River area. Now, these things I do relate to. And the Heightsbury thoroughbreds, and I relate to that because that's where the collection is stored out on that particular property. It's actually called Heightsbury, isn't it? Mm. Yeah, hold on. And what a collection. Anyway, so welcome, Janet.
Thank you.
No, you can go home now. So just to, I mean, I have my own little stories about when and where and how I met Janet, but probably you've had enough of my voice for a few minutes, so I'll start with Janet about, perhaps even, you know, given we're talking about Emily here, how, in fact, you know, if she... I'm not talking to you anyway, I'm talking to you. yeah, so where, did you meet Emily and... How and what circumstances?
I did meet Emily only once or twice. And unlike a lot of people who met Emily once or twice, I'm not going to say I knew Emily. Yeah. You don't get to know someone when you meet them once, but you shake hands and have a cuddle, have shed a few tears because... You're pretty emotional when you meet someone like that who's been a part of, in a way, a part of my life for several years. But I met her when she came to Perth at the time of the unveiling, if you like, of the works which I call the scholarship works. And I don't know whether you want me to talk about the scholarship now or...
Yeah, well, actually, we'll put this into context. So that was probably the... wasn't the first. Like we might just, that's a really good point. Let's go back to how the Homes of Court got involved with the art from Utopia, which of course then included Emily. So what was the first sort of involvement?
The first involvement was via Anne Brody with Rodney Gooch and Christopher Hodges. And I guess amongst the first purchases were the collection of Utopia silks, the 88 silks that were produced actually at the time of the bicentenary.
Yeah,
and they were such a wonderful body of works that I felt they needed to be kept together. So we purchased those. And since that time, of course, they've had an amazing life. they've been to a couple of times to America. They've been to Paris to the Australian Embassy. Recently, last year in November, I took them to China, to Shanghai for a few weeks in a wonderful gallery in Shanghai that was actually a deconsecrated Taoist temple. And you can imagine these floating, you know, very, for me, very religious works in a Chinese temple was quite, they looked quite spectacular and they were very well received there. But it was through buying those that we started a connection with the Utopia people. who I believe we're so lucky to have, Rodney, looking after them, nurturing them. And then later, after we'd bought those, it was when Rodney gave the women canvas and paint and taught them how to apply the paint to the canvas, and they did their first series of paintings, which I also felt it was important to keep together. And, of course, in amongst the batiks, there were the batiks by Emily, one of which is here, and in the first paintings which they did was Emily's picture. And I thought of that yesterday when Krista was talking about how Rodney was sifting through a whole lot of batiks that came in, and suddenly one just... Yes, and one stood out, and of course that was Emily's. Well, with the paintings, the first painting that people find in this exhibition, which is the first painting Emily did, I mean, it's just totally different from everyone else's, any other painting that's ever been done on the planet.
Including your own later.
That's right. So they were kept together. But I guess what I'm leading up to is when I first met Emily, and I became very aware of the fact that, unlike my non-Indigenous artist friends who would often say, and as they still do now, oh, I'm working for an exhibition next November, or I've got to have 10 paintings ready for March 2011. And so they have the luxury of putting together a body of work, checking it, discarding it, working on it, modifying it, tossing it in the bin if they don't like it. At that time, and I think it's probably still the same, people like Emily were not able to have that luxury. They were painting a picture, it's gone, painting another one, it's gone. And I felt it was really important that Emily should have the opportunity of painting for maybe a year, not having to sell everything, and then at the end of a year having a luxury that a non-Indigenous artist has of looking at, where have I been? What have I done in that time? So we weren't specifically thinking of Emily at that time. We decided that we would give two scholarships to the people of Utopia to paint for a year. Rodney was going to collect their works, then we'd exhibit them. They could see what had happened to them in that time. Well, one of them, we chose two young men. One of them decided that he liked football better than painting, so he went off to be an Australian rules football player. And the other one decided he didn't want to do it anyway. So the logical thing to do was to say to Emily, we'll give you some money. We don't want anything in return for it. We'll give you the money so you don't have to sell everything you produce. Work for a year, Rodney will look after them, and then we'll have a look at them. Mm. And another artist we chose was Louis Pearl. Mm. Well, it's a very interesting story because everyone knows how many paintings Emily must have done in a year, and somehow, you know, Rodney managed to rescue about 25.
Oh.
So there were 25 works of Emily's and about, I think, 15 Louis Pearl's. All the others had gone the way of the previous paintings, and they were packed up in Karma and brought to Perth, and Emily came to Perth to see those works.
This is 89.
89. Must have been... my life revolves around not BC and AC, but BR and, you know, before Robert and after Robert. So 1990. I know this must have been 89 because he was still alive. Yeah. Emily came to Perth for the unveiling of these pictures, and when she arrived, we hadn't unpacked them yet, we started getting phone calls from people saying, I want to buy those works. I want one of those works. I want two of those works. Emily was totally puzzled. How can people say they want to buy my works? They haven't seen them. And there was a crisis, which you probably remember, because Emily said, I'm not going to paint anymore. I mean, this is all not in the words I'm using, but these were the meanings of the words she was making. I am not going to paint anymore. this is lunacy. People have not seen these works, but they want to buy them. And it was a while, it took a while for her to be convinced that it was time. But that was when I met her.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's somewhere in the, it was the exhibition was at the Perth Institute of Contemporary Art, and somewhere in there, archives is the most marvellous photograph of Robert Holmes Court and Emily meeting on the steps, and this patrician, elegant man in his grey pinstripe suit or whatever, and this wonderful woman whose face we see so much here meeting, and this the eye contact and the respect, because Emily was aware that we had been collecting her paintings and we weren't, you know, we were like Christopher, if you like, we bought them because we loved them, we related to them, we weren't going to buy them and flog them off to someone else for huge profit. She understood that. So this, the eye contact between these two is really beautiful.
Was she dressed in all, what was she dressed in, the colourful stuff?
Yes, yes, she was, and I mainly remember the shoes.
Yeah, there's always something the sneakers. She's wearing, you remember. That's why I asked the question. Yeah,
yeah, she was wearing sneakers.
Pink or sequins, perhaps?
Yeah, something, yes.
For those who've seen images of Emily, oh, she just loved colours, and any of the money, when she did get any of it after what was left when she passed it around, she'd always buy brightly coloured hats or T-shirts or whatever, and skirts, of course, were to be worn not just around the waist but, you know, around the head or anywhere. And the, in fact, the photo, I don't know whether it's in one of the... Anyway, there is a photo, I'm just trying to remember whether it's published in those books or not, when she's signing for the to receive the Keating Fellowship, you know, creative... It's in the catalogue? This one, which one, the first or second?
Yeah,
yeah, the black one, new one. That's very new. It's only a day old.
You told us it was sold out the day before, Margot.
Yeah,
so,
all the advances. We're getting some more. Anyway, so she wore, as she was signing, she had the skirt around her head. So it's quite, it's so, like what you're saying, this sort of disjunction between how you should be and how you shouldn't be and how you are. Another time she wears a Marilyn Monroe T-shirt and, you know, big celebrity star, and for the Keating Fellowship she wore to actually collect it, not when she was signing it in the camp, but was a cyan blue hat with pink sequins and then a range of other colours everywhere else. So the short would throw in her, and her personality is very much her personality. So you mob met her like within, she started painting at Christmas over 88, 89, and so you guys were fairly early on with meeting her as a painter
as
on
a
canvas.
Painter. Yes, that's right.
And then what, so after that workshop of 25, what, you know, you just intimated there about how people were wanting to buy her work, like that's within a year of her painting.
Yeah.
And this interest in her work straight away obviously was the beginning of the money industry, if you like, that unfortunately grew up around it.
Yeah, I think that whole commodification of Aboriginal art is something I am deeply offended about. I know we live in a materialistic society where everyone's thinking about money all the time, but I have to tell you the story, two stories, because I find them so amazing. I arrived in Canberra on Thursday, and when I was checking in at the hotel, I noticed a man standing beside me. Before I'd even had time to leave the check-in counter and go to my room and put my bags down, this fellow had shown me his card and said... it's almost like, you know, we're in Paris. He's the dirty postcard. I've got a 30-foot Emily on the wall in my gallery you might like to buy. And then I believe last night there was a huge sale of Emily paintings in Canberra. Now, I just find it appalling, frankly. I've come to Canberra, and I think probably everyone in this room has come to Canberra or come to this gallery to pay homage to this amazing woman, this 20th century phenomenon, if you like, sitting out there in the dirt, out in the centre of Australia, under the sun and the sky and a piece of corrugated iron, producing work that takes us beyond anything any of us have ever seen before, quite frankly. Well, for me it does. Yeah, for me it does. And people are around the corner
doing the...
Very sad. And I have to say, I think Emily would be sad about that. And I think the story about Emily saying, well, I'm not going to paint if these people will want to buy my paintings because they're my paintings, not without seeing them, is something that I find extremely sad, extremely sad. Yeah. And also, of course, you know, everyone, when I was walking around this gallery the first night, I heard people talking about the prices. So-and-so paid $1 million for this, so-and-so paid this. And you think, did any Indigenous person benefit from that? Mm. You know, someone, he paid $5,000, he just got $1 million for it. And you think, okay, $995,000 is the difference there. Has any Indigenous person benefited from this? Is any Indigenous child going to be educated because of that? It's not good.
Yeah, it'd be very interesting to know what she thought. Obviously, she had thoughts about that from the beginning when she said what she said to you about people wanting to buy a work without even seeing. That in itself is actually quite offensive, isn't it? That all I see, the only value I see in your work is what commercial value it will have for me. And of course that has proliferated and continued. But at the same time, that mustn't take away from the celebration of her work, and it doesn't, because, in fact, it just makes it more offensive. So it's one of those great ironies, you know it's a reality that it's there but it's true. I mean, in my line of business where I've been involved with for a very long time, there's not too many things I haven't seen or heard related to all of this, so it's one has to keep above it and keep one's eyes on what I'm here to do anyway, which is to collect and show the best of Emily. So clearly I have to deal not necessarily in some of those worlds, but I have to keep sight on what it is I'm doing and why I'm doing it. And it's about Emily, it's about Emily, it's about Emily. So so it's, and
but
it's
for me,
a long story.
It's a bit like going to the Sistine Chapel and setting up a hamburger stall. Because you know there are going to be lots of people going there, so you think, well, we'll flog something off here. Anyway, I know I have to rise above that too, Margot, but it hurts me Emily's point of view.
You have to keep... That's the way to deal with it. I mean, I deal with it all the time. You have to sort of find a way of getting out of the... It sort of dirties you if you stay in there, so...
Can I just...
Yeah, sure.
This is not about Emily or Utopia, but I don't know. An Aboriginal woman artist from Warburton died last week. Can I say her name, or is that?
In here seems to be okay.
Yeah. Her name was Myra Lawson. Myra Lawson, Warburton is 600 k's from Uluru back into Western Australia. And Myra Lawson was one of the well known artists amongst the Warburton women, and she worked out that if a painting had her signature on the bottom, she could get a little bit more money than the other people. So she started doing something amazing. She started painting canvases about 2 metres by 1 metre, where she wrote, Myra Lawson. And then she filled in around the edges. Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. And people bought them. I bought one because I thought, this is an Aboriginal woman who is taking the mickey out of us completely.
And that's a very interesting point, because Emily's known for not being backward in exploiting the exploiters too. And she used to say things like, No, she didn't say it, but others said what actually happened. She gave people, as what Christopher said, what they deserve. So rubbish people got rubbish art, good people got good art, and she charged the rubbish people even more than the government for the rubbish art. So she had this whole other way of dealing with it, obviously very early in the piece. That she wasn't going to be rolled. So, I mean, clearly you're weak in the times. It must be totally, you know, crippling. And then she'd just go bush and disappear, you know. Mm. Or sometimes she was given bolts of canvas and she'd just, you know, give it to the dogs or the kids or sink it in the river or something. At the end, she was dealing the cards.
Yes.
The end, she just knew that... not to say she wasn't overworked and there's so many demands on her from her community and from the market and there's a lot of stuff going on, but she sorted out very quickly, exactly as Myra did. You know, you'll get what you want and you'll pay for it. Anyway, we might just move on to the Warburton Project. I'd love to... Janet's worked with lots of Indigenous communities and art in various ways, and Warburton is the latest project that she's really excited about. So you might like to tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I was in Perth in 1993 when we had the most amazing director, first director of the Perth Institute of Contemporary Art, who was an Irishman called Noel Sheridan. And I'd mentioned Noel yesterday without giving his name, I think, but I took him to the shed where a lot of the art is kept, and it's an air-conditioned shed, by the way. It's not...
It's quite nice.
It's
really
an okay shed. And I was saying yesterday how Noel, without any baggage about Aboriginal people or Australia's history of our relationships with Indigenous people, just completely plugged into Indigenous art. In fact, he talked about the Book of Kells, which when you think about it, is really interesting. But in 1993, Noel brought almost the entire Warburton community down to Perth, 10 tonnes of red earth spread over the main gallery of Pika, and had them camped out the back. He only allowed them to bring 4 dogs because that was a bit excessive. He had
to
go...
Not 4 each.
No, just 4. So we had men, women and children. He organised, because it was cold at that time of year, organised for them to go to op shops and get lots of warm clothing, and they camped at the back, and somehow Noel managed to find kangaroo tails to cook in the fires and so on. I said to him one night, Noel, have you got permission from the city of Perth to do this? Oh, Christ, no, Janice, he said. You could never get permission to do this. It was the most marvellous time. They were there for about 2 weeks, living, camping in the centre of Perth. I remember images of white, non-Indigenous children having their first experience of playing in the dirt with Indigenous people. It was fantastic. But anyway, the people from Warburton were extremely fortunate in that they had not only an art advisor, but they had some money. And they made a decision that instead of painting, selling, they would themselves make up a collection of Warburton work. And they kept the bulk of their work. And Margot, their room where they keep this, or twice as big as this area, I suppose, is an Aladdin's cave. I once went in England to a place where they sell Persian carpets, always on sale, of course, 20% off.
Liquidation sale, closing down.
Yeah. They had mountains of the Persian carpets, and that's what it's like at Warburton. Wow. They have piles like this of paintings, and you just peel them back, and it just...
These are paintings.
Paintings, like you've never seen. This one, actually, it's got the blue in it.
Yeah.
Warburton women were using blue in a way you'd never seen anyone else except for Emily using. Amazing stuff. Anyway... that, well, in Warburton, it's fascinating. The only thing you can be in Warburton is an artist. I kid you not.
Yeah.
They do slump glass work for architects all around the world. They pot, they sculpt, they paint. The young people in their art centre design fabrics and make clothes. They are, the young kids are doing some astonishing photography. They write music, they record it, they sing, they dance. There is nothing else to do except be an artist. As far as I can see. I mean, you can run the shop.
Yeah.
You can run the shop. Amazing.
Sell food to the artists.
It's sell food to the artists, that's right. They've tried, for a long time, we won't sell anything. Of course, financial situations catch up with everybody, and now they've had to start selling works and thinking of what they can do to make their art centre more sustainable. So a woman from Perth a couple of years ago went up and started teaching them the art of felting. And I don't know how many people here know about felting. And they are doing remarkable work. And the work I've got in the Holmes & Cook Gallery in Perth at the moment is the first 11 major works which they've done, plus several other smaller works. They are absolutely amazing, and to my great joy, when I went to see them earlier this year in Warburton, the painting which I can remember, like I can remember these paintings, indelibly printed in my head. I saw this particular painting in 1993 when they were in Perth. It's been made in felt. And so I felt once again that these are the first works these women have done on felt. It is really important that they are kept together, and they can no longer afford to keep their works. They have to sell them. So I've bought those 11 works and put them in the Holmes & Cook collection so that, and I promised them that they won't just go out. They will be together. And then forever they can come back and say, well, what are the works we, show us the first works we did, because we want to see how we've developed. But I'm talking too much. You're supposed
I'm only here to prompt you. No, this is an achievement, is... Janet, keeping me quiet. I'm just supposed
but
to
there is a great thing happened, because we, like Margot, we always, whenever we have Indigenous works exhibitions in the Holmes & Cook Gallery, we bring the relevant, you know, the people from the communities down, and we had 7 women from Warburton come down for a week for the opening and so on, and to talk. And on Sunday last week, the 7 of them came into the gallery, and I must say, they sat on some of the paintings, and of course, I'm thinking, oh. But they're their paintings, because we have some of the paintings that inspired the felt, and they are sort of on platform, so they're sitting on them, but they're their paintings, so that's okay.
No conservators. Is Eric here?
No conservators there. But they, each woman told the story of her particular picture, except one woman who's very worried, because she, when she'd finished, she realised she'd actually done a man's story, so we weren't allowed to talk about that. But one of the ladies was telling the story of her felt, and she got halfway through and she sort of lost track. And I was so reminded of myself and my old schoolmates, who, when we start singing a song and we think, God, what's the next line of that? And we go back to the beginning and we've got to start and come right through. I'm sure everyone knows what I'm talking about. She got halfway through telling this story and you see a fault, and so she went, okay. And she started right at the beginning singing that story, and then she was able to tell us. It's tear-jerking stuff, Margaret. Because at that time I had a few people in the gallery who are starting a Baroque music festival in Perth. And I had said to them, there is nothing Baroque about these works, okay? They are absolutely real and undecorated. I mean, Baroque music is decorated music. They are nothing decorated about this. And when she did that, it was so fantastic because you could see this is absolutely real. She had to go back to the beginning to get the gist of it. Fantastic.
This is a really important insight. We actually touched on this at lunchtime. In relation to Emily and in relation to a universal thing, we talk about Emily's work and this artist and many other artists, is the, especially in Indigenous societies where that kind of connection with the earth is still abundant, is this idea of always being in touch with the source, always being in touch with the ancestral source of who you are. So when we talk about Emily, just to sort of take it into Emily for a minute, is all her works are about her ancestral home of Alhalkara. Every single work is the same subject. In fact, that whole exhibition is really one painting. You know, so then you can break it down to chapters, if you like, in one book. But it's one book. And so she's doing exactly what Janet was saying. Mm. Every work, she goes back and connects with Alhalkara. Now, along that journey, she might do the body stripes because that's what you do on your body to connect your body to Alhalkara. She might do the seeds because Kame, the yam, her middle name is... her major dreaming story on Alhalkara. So doing the seeds is just about Alhalkara. So no matter how different all these paintings, every time she's doing exactly what Jen's saying, she's going back to the source, back to the source. And, you know, and I think, you know, and even though we individually, we do the same in a whole range of different ways, and I know I'm not supposed to be talking, but...
No, just keep going. You're keeping me quiet, and that's an achievement.
We're good for each other. But just one thing is, it reminds an old, very quick, exactly this, an old Inuit man in a native title hearing, he was going on and on and on about the story, connecting the country, why it's ours, and so on, and the young the lawyer was saying, yeah, come on, get on with it, you know, and he's going on, this stage, it's still going on, and this fella's getting really quite impatient and everyone's shuffling and ready to go home. We've got nowhere near what they're supposed to be talking about, and this fella's pressing him, and eventually the old Inuit man said, oh, but I'm not even born yet. So he's part of the story. So anyway, I think that's an interesting little... I keep that in my head when I'm looking at paintings like this and other Indigenous paintings. If you keep a little story like that in your head, you kind of get it. All right, I'll stop talking now.
No, I... just because this one's popped up now, I really would like to talk about that painting because... I mean, I'm conscious that I've got all sorts of experts around me, so if I'm talking rubbish, save up the questions for afterwards. But it seems to me that there is not the hierarchical structure amongst Indigenous artists that there is in amongst our artists. I mean, people think, okay, Jackson Pollock, he comes first up there with Rothko, and then someone else is down there, and there's a hierarchy and people accept that. Mm. The women in Utopia were quite puzzled at early on and must have been in 1990, something like that, 92. Quite puzzled about why, when someone popped through the fence to get Emily to paint or whoever it was, they may hand over $20 where they only got two, or they might give her 200 and they got 20 or whatever the figures were. I don't know what the figures were, but they couldn't understand why Emily got more. So Rodney Gooch said at one stage women were going off to do some sorry business in the riverbed or the creek bed or somewhere and said, okay, here's a canvas and here's some paint. All of you go away and paint an Emily. So Emily and 24 of her women friends went off. And this was a painting that Emily, that they had seen Emily do. And Rodney said, okay, well, that's Emily's yam dreaming. All go away and paint Emily's yam dreaming. Well, they painted 25 pictures. They came 24 by Emily's sisters and relations, and one by Emily. And we brought them to Perth, and they were unpacked and hung in a gallery in Pekka again. And I went in to see them, and there were 24 pictures that looked a bit like that. But there's one that's the closest thing Emily ever did to a de Kooning, I think. Amazing. So, like, Christopher was talking yesterday about how Emily was always off and somewhere else.
Yep.
This is an astonishing thing. Mm. I've got all of those paintings and they're all over the place because people like them. Mm. And they're basically that sort of thing in one form or another, basic structures there. But Emily's one. She'd already moved on, yes. And that, to me, that's such a wonderful thing. And it's also wonderful when non-Indigenous artists do that. I met Lloyd Rees and we became quite close when he was 90. And Lloyd Rees could have stopped developing when people started buying those beautiful pencil sketches. And he would have had enough money to live on for the rest of his life. But unlike a lot of artists who find a formula that works, okay, let's churn these out because we'll make lots of money. Lloyd Rees, 90, he could hardly see, but he was still trying to work out how best he could paint light. And Emily, the same. They can't help themselves. Mm. They are so imbued with this spirit of advancement and development and improvement and...
That's really interesting, the school of Emily's.
Yes.
Yeah, which is, imagine if that happened now with now the industry is so fraught with this fakes and copies and lookalikes. And did Emily really do it or did she have help? And I mean, that's just so kind of right up front dealing with the issue of the day as you should.
Yes.
And everyone was involved in doing this and painting like Emily, and Emily wasn't perturbed, was she? She didn't give a stuff.
No.
She'd already, though, as far
she
as she's...
already...
It was almost like
somewhere.
A legacy. This is what I've done. It's for you, Mob, now I'm going elsewhere. And I said this morning, too, about her paintings were like ceremonies. Her canvas is actually a ceremonial ground. And once she's finished on that surface, it actually has no further value to her. It only becomes value when it crosses the zone into this other world, which is not her world, the art mark or the non-Indigenous world, and then it becomes a possession for a different kind of set of values. But it's like, you know, in ceremonies, she gets up, all general ceremonies, do it on the sand or wherever, and then erase the design and turn you back on, and the power that was generated during that ceremony is now infused and, you know, gone into the source for which it was intended. And the same if you see her painting, and you might remember the big yam one, there's a film in there, I don't know whether you see the end of it, you might, but when she's, after 2 days, she's doing big yam, she gets up and you can see, you can tell in her body language, you don't have to know anything. Hey, she just gets up and turns her back on and
walks
all
off.
She wants is a tucker and a brown bread or white bread. And it's, she couldn't give a flying whatever about what happens to that painting after that. And curators and all sorts of people trying to do the right thing and come to which way should I hang it? Should I do it here? And is it all right, this? And she just, like, flicks them off, you know. It's almost like, I've done my job. I've done my bit. It's your responsibility. What are you bugging me for? So it's so different from the non-Indigenous world, and it's very much characterised by that story about all the Emilys. Mm. You know, she wouldn't bother her.
But that sort of is interesting. I can't remember who said what over the last 2 days because I've heard so many people talking about so many intellectual things that I've been fascinated by, but we do bring our Western brains to it. And I mean, that's very interesting in the light of my thing that, oh, you know, we have to let Emily look at where she's been for a year.
Mm.
And you've just told me she couldn't give a damn. No. So there were, the scholarship, it didn't matter really.
No.
Okay.
But I
did it with the best of intentions.
It did matter, but differently. Old Aboriginal saying, same but different. Actually, the homes I can't tell you really how important the homes are caught. The combination of Rodney Goots, who you've heard Janet speak of, who was working for Karma at the time, for those who don't know, which is an Aboriginal organisation, Alice Springs, called the Central Australian Aboriginal Media Association. I often get that wrong, but
that's
I didn't.
Right.
But that's right, Karma still exists. And they'd been looking after media and radio and other things for Indigenous people. And Rodney Goots was the right man in the right place in that organisation at the time. He had a mate called Christopher Hodges. Christopher Hodges, who currently is director of Utopia Arts Sydney in... I shouldn't give you a whole history lesson. Anyway, very quick. In Sydney, and who was a marketing arm, really, for the Utopia artists when they started. But they wouldn't have started. They may never have started if, in fact, that walk started, continued without the support of the Homes of Court Collection, then Robert Holmes and Court Foundation. Was that correct?
I think it was just us buying it.
And fortunately, there's another girl, a woman called Anne Brodie, who happened to be the curator of the Holmes and Court Collection. And so she recommended, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that this first canvases, well, sorry, before that, the batik projects were actually supported by the Holmes and Court Collection. So those batiks had somewhere to go. If they have somewhere to go, then there's another lot fills the vacuum. And then they had somewhere to go as part of really well-conceived projects. And the first 100 canvases that were delivered to Utopia and left for 3 weeks, and then Rodney Goots and them came back and picked up 81 of them, which were painted on, and one of which was Emily's, which all went into this collection. They're talking to Christopher Hodges and them, you know, having the Holmes Court mob take that into their collection. It was a targeted, not targeted for commercial investment purposes, purely support and encouragement. Without that, who knows? The hawkers would have come in and changed the course of history, or it would never have gone anywhere, or everyone was so disillusioned the batik was not making any kind of economic return. Who knows? So, but I don't think anyone could say if it wasn't for that kind of support at that time with those people in that way, that people like Emily and them may never have emerged to the point, you know, we see today. That's a bit of a testimonial. Well, okay, Jen, are you still there? There's some lovely blue panels that come up here. This is you. And I've asked Janet about those because she had a very special way of, as she does about most things, a very special way of hanging these 5 blue panels. You've seen them pass a few times, haven't you? Yeah.
Well, these panels we bought very early on. They're very early works of Emily's.
Mm.
And they... Yes. Now, they must have been bought before 1990 because of Robert. Originally, we had them for a few months in an apartment in Melbourne in Robert's study. And then we decided that we wanted to live with them. So that's my 50th birthday present, by the way. My Emily watering can.
Still gift wrapped.
I know you're amazed that I'm 50.
No.
Nobody said, oh.
Didn't think you got that far already.
But the blue panels, anyway, I took them home and we hung them on the ceiling in our house. We had a ceiling that had a slightly vaulted ceiling, and we hung them in there. They just fitted perfectly. And You lie on the couch underneath them and just imagine that you were looking into deep space, but behind the deep space and so on, you can see the Emily's story. I believe that painting was an introduction to Indigenous art. For a lot of my daughter was the only one of my children living at home then. She was a student at UWA, and her friends fell in love with that painting and I think got to know a bit about Indigenous art through that. And when somebody, maybe it was you, Margot, borrowed them after a while and they disappeared, I can remember this young man, young university student, probably studying law or economics or something boring, coming in and saying, walking into the room and saying, "Oh my God, the Emilies have gone." Just terrible, yes. I actually live with those. They're in my, Margot's seen them at home in my sitting room, and takes 10 screws to put them on the wall, 2 for each panel. And when Margot borrowed them, we took them down, but we left the screws there because they're going back. Okay?
We can't go to New York, I mean.
Yes, if you want them for New York, definitely. No, you can borrow them any time. Yeah, but
that's just a fantasy. It's not a reality. Don't go reporting in the papers or anything like that.
Why not?
Because I get into trouble. Unless you've got influence. Talk to us later.
No, I did say yesterday, and I don't know how many people here, but I have just been to New York with a friend of mine who's an artist, and we spent 7 days looking at art. And we honestly did keep saying to each other, you know, there's something missing here, and that's Australian Indigenous art. It, we saw 45 commercial galleries, and then all the major ones, and one gallery had some Indigenous art in it, which I frankly didn't think was all that brilliant. But you do feel there is something missing in a city that is so, you know, central. You know, you do think, well, the Americans obviously had all the money in the world. They bought all the best Impressionist and Post-Impressionist work and they put them in New York. Mm. But they haven't got an Emily.
No.
You know, and it's a real...
Yet Japan has.
It's a real gap in their understanding of art.
Yeah, it's quite a long conversation, but you know, why that might be and why it's in Japan. But Japan is because of one passionate man, in terms of initiating the idea and seeing it through. Mm. And I heard someone say this morning about the perception is that Japan was, the Japanese wanted the Japanese, like a whole lot of people wanted Emily in Japan. They'd never heard of her.
That's right.
Or Australia or any of that. So it was just really the passion of one man that's actually driven it, and then all of us have got on the help along the way. Now, that actually blue paint story is a good one, because I often use that one to people who, when they say to me, "Oh, I can't possibly buy any art, I really, really love it. I can afford it, but I can't buy it. Got no more walls." Well, the obvious answer is, you know, good enough for Janet, it's good enough for you. Hang it on your ceiling. I mean, people put mirrors above their bed, don't they? So I just was... we're actually nearly running out of time. That hour went really quickly, didn't it? I'll just see if there's... Perhaps we could just tell just one thing about about the collection, actually, would be interesting, I think, for people here to know. I went out at the Heightsbury at the Stud Farm, which is about 40 minutes or so, depending. If you're driving with Janet, it's 40 minutes. But it's about an hour when you go with them. The Ronan film crew didn't get there. I remember you rang me once and said, "Where's that film crew?"
So I would probably never say that.
They're probably driving safely. Probably just leaving Perth, and Janet already got there. But anyway, it's a. I went out there the last time I did the retrospective, and the minute Emily Project comes up, and this is really only the second time, the first place I go, the first contact I make is with the Holmes & Court collection, because they have, they're the only ones who have that early period. Thank God, you know. The only ones who have those early works. Who knows what happened to the others and may not be anymore, actually, because she actually developed so fast that the early period occupied about 1 year. So I go out there and it's the best run, organised looking storeroom of art I have ever seen. So all these institutions, excuse me, anyone who's been, are always overcrowded, too much, too many, can't be found, almost found. So, you know, despite everything else, they're really, and there's a whole lot of good reasons for it both ways, of course, but I was so amazed, and Janet took me last time, and the works we need to see, the card was there, the work was where it should be, it was just, it was extraordinary. So well done, you and your curator. So well, could you perhaps just tell the people just a little bit about what you have in the Indigenous area, well, not in general, but the Indigenous area and Emily.
Right. Well, we started collecting art in 1966 when we were married. Mm. We lived in the hills outside Perth in a place called Darlington, which was a bit of an art colony. And Robert used to say he was the only person who didn't wear a smock. And we bought, there used to be a Darlington show every year, and the sort of people who lived there were Bob Juniper and Guy Gray-Smith, Vint Boissevain, Brian McKay and so on. So we started off collecting their paintings. And then after a while we started going to auctions and buying Nolans and Fred Williams and Drysdales and Nobels and things like that. And then we employed a curator whose specialty was, Roderick Anderson, whose specialty was early West Australian art. Mm. So we collected that as well. And there's a very big number of, there are about 5,000 works in the collection. But say around 700 of them are early West Australian works, a lot of which are not great art. I'm the first to admit that, but they are great history, great history. The first painting of Perth Water, painted 2 years before West Australian was settled. There's even a Rover Thomas of Perth, actually, which is, he painted a picture of Perth.
A man called Rover Thomas?
No, Rover Thomas himself, when he came to Perth once, Mary got him to paint a picture of Perth, the Swan River.
Oh,
amazing.
Really?
But so there are maybe 25 views of Perth from King's Park painted between 1826 and 1945, and by then Perth had been destroyed by the developers, so there was no point in painting it anymore. So there's a lot of early West Australian work. There are a lot of Australian works, massive number of works on paper, which are the bane of your existence because they're so hard to look after. But I think the first Indigenous works we bought really were the Sandman paintings, the collection. I went to see it in London. This was an exhibition of works from Papunya. Amazing things. They were shown, must have been 80 or 70 or something like that. When did they? When
maybe
did Barton? 82. 81. They were shown in London at the Museum of Man, and we were in London, and I went down and saw these, and I just went back to Robert and said, you know,
can you increase my pocket money?
Yes, yes. We have got to have them. We've got to have them. So we bought that. Again, that's a collection of works that must never be broken up. Mm. In fact, a few years ago, we had a curator who shall remain nameless, who gave one away as a present to someone who was leaving Heytesbury. And she must have asked my permission, but didn't actually say, Janet, don't you remember, this is part of that Sandman group. So we've had to buy him another present. Mm. and another one was actually sold by her at auction. And again, I'm culpable. I must have said, yes, it's okay to sell it.
When you're busy.
Why? And in fact, the person who bought that, when I rang him and said, look, that was a terrible mistake, it's part of this collection, he said, come pick it up, you know, just give me the money back that you...
Oh.
and fabulous. Keep the frame. So there are very nice people out there. But once, I'm sure everybody in this room knows this, once you start collecting things, you become a compulsive, and it's a sort of a disease, but also other people start approaching you. And at one time I suddenly said to Robert, do you realise we've got about 25 paintings in the collection of women? And somewhere out in the ether, someone heard me say that. So every art dealer in the world started sending us paintings of women. And, in fact, we had an exhibition of those paintings of women at SA2 and Gallery. So once people know you're collecting early West Australian art, it all comes out of the woodwork. The West Australian collection, of course, was much easier to put together because we were there. The 80s, when everyone did paintings that were about 7 metres long and 4 metres high, we've got lots of those, and they're quite hard to hang. But they're great to lend to people. But the Indigenous part was the part that really captured us so much. And I always, from about 1967, I think, I always had in my head that one day I will have an art gallery. So it's a totally different thing to collect art because you love it in your sitting room or to collect art because you think one day you're going to have a gallery. I have to say I never have bought anything that I didn't like, and I sometimes am amazed when I see things and I can remember exactly where I bought it and why I bought it. And so many of the things in the collection have been bought so that when I get the gallery, I'll have, you know, enough of them. Because you see something, you think, oh, that would... I mean, I bought a work a while ago by a girl called Joy Lovegrove. Exquisite painting of ice breaking up, the polar ice cap breaking up. She was artist in residence on a ship down there. She's not Indigenous. But the wonderful lines on that work are so related to the lines on some of the Indigenous bark paintings that I think one day I'm going to have an exhibition of those works. Last year we had an exhibition in the gallery of works from women in New Guinea who live below Mount Lamington, which is at the end of the Kokoda Track. They were not on bark like Indigenous bark, but bark that's been beaten.
Like
tarpa. Yes, yeah. And the patterns on these, Margot, are exactly the same as the patterns on Indigenous paintings. I mean, so you have to have a few of those. You have to buy a few of those so you
but
can put them in.
You've got a gallery now.
So I've got the gallery.
Well, we're waiting for that to show. That's a really cross-cultural... Mm. This is like the Emily thing, the universal, what is it that connects in a visual language that's beyond the sort of the text or spoken language. There is a universal visual language, dots, lines, circles, space, colour. Anyway, I'm going to have to show up.
Can I just tell them one more story?
Can she?
I am.
She's supposed to finish at 3.
I'm very spoiled, but this is a quick story because it relates to something someone said yesterday, but... I'm spoilt because I've actually got two galleries. One is in East Perth, where you've been, but the other one is a huge space at the winery, which used to be the old winery, and when we built a new winery, we converted this into a gallery and performance space. And we have the ACO down there for 3 days in December and so on and so on and so on. But we have the exhibitions we have there are all from the collection. We just closed an exhibition which I just called the Great Big Picture Show because they were all great big pictures. And I'm going
but
to
Emily's
do...
wasn't in it.
No, because you had it. We did have some Indigenous work mixed in
big.
With it.
Yeah. I'm just talking big.
And I'm going to have one that's just called Black and White Show because I've got a lot of art that's just black or white. But at the moment we've got in there about 60 pictures from Hermannsburg. One Albert Namatjira and all the others are by his group. And when we bought this collection, I sort of looked at it and you think, oh, yeah, that's the Namat Geo. Yes, these are all quite nice. But revisiting it about 10 years later and putting them up, Margot, it's a story someone's got to tell. It is fantastic. And someone yesterday was talking about the influence of Namat Geo.
Yes.
Well, I mean, we all know Namat Geo and that's what we aspire to have. But my God, in there, there are some wonderful painters from Hermannsburg. And we've actually hung those at one on three walls of this big space. And on the other wall, we've put some of the Hermannsburg paintings that are coming out now.
Yeah.
The more traditional ones. So
that's
very interesting.
Is that exhibition still up? You invite a couple of people like those who spoke about Namat Geo and his interfacing model. Do a workshop there in terms of assessing it and picking out all those other threads that haven't been looked at forever.
Mm.
And out of that sort of come up with some ways of looking at it.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's another thing for another time. Okay, you can see we would have no problem going on all night. That's even without a glass of wine. That's with a lousy glass of water. Imagine if it was wine. You see, the word Emily is the trigger point. So you say Emily and then...
yeah. Look, I've tried to control that. And I tried very hard on Thursday night because I thought, you know, this is major. I'm so privileged to have been asked to speak here between the hours of 6:57 and 7:01, which was on my itinerary. So I have to do it. I can't crack up. But for me, there's huge stuff going on in my head when I think about Emily. I think about that photograph with the nose hole and the rock. I think about this amazing woman that I had a hug from. I think about my mum, who taught at an Aboriginal kindergarten on the outskirts of Perth in the flight path into the airport called Alawa Grove. And I think about a couple of hundred years of what amounts in my mind to abuse. I think about the introduction of alcohol and petrol sniffing and the sort of semi-destruction of a culture. And it all sort of pours out of me when I see this amazing work that, I mean, I can't participate, although I did in Japan, in the discussions about modernism and postmodernism and this and that and the other, because I just want people to think this woman is one of the most amazing artists of the 20th century. And I really believe that we should be thinking about her as, you know, the school of Emily or the Australian Indigenous School or something. But I feel it's a shame, and Margot, because she's an academic and I'm not, has explained to me that Janet people will always want to write about her. They will always want to put her in boxes. They will always want to classify it. But I want everyone to just think this is a phenomenal person who we happen to have lived in the same time as. How amazing would it be? I'm mad about music and I can get the same feeling when I listen to Beethoven and I think, he's this guy, he's deaf, he can't hear. And he's writing this stuff. Here's Emily, who's sitting in the dirt.
Elderly. Dogs, kids,
dirt, corrugated iron, and she's churning out this stuff. So I'm sorry, but it's a long story, but there's just so much that happens in my head when I look at her work.
Well, I think that's probably the right note to finish on. Would you agree? Yeah. Otherwise, I might talk about that word. Mm. Modernist. No. Thank you, Jo.
But you give me a clap. I'm going to give you a clap. Margot, this has been an astonishing journey for me. I had never been to Japan before, as you know. I went to Osaka.
She's a groupie.
I then thought, I'm going back to Tokyo. And you and your team of people from the National Museum, Benita sitting there and Eric, Sonia, wherever he is, and Sonia and Carol, have given me a year when we were supposed to not get in aeroplanes. This has been my year of the plane. I've used up lots of carbon credits.
Oh, that's right.
But you've given not just me, but everybody here and 130,000 people in Japan and hopefully many more than that here, a most astonishing privilege of being part of this and being introduced to this great woman. So I give you a clap.
Coming from Janet, that's high compliment. Emily and I have made a deadly team along the way. So thank you very much, everyone, for coming.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.